Now Seagull was a soldier, and he sailed across the sea with the 1st Anzac Brigade. From the landing at Gallipoli till the war clouds left the skies, he'd wandered around the continent, a tourist in disguise. Then after years of battling, when 3 parts full of lead, the ammo said, "We'll send you home." Then old Seagull said, "I'm going back again to Yarrawonga."
Yes, we'll join in. Darawonga, Lingalonga. What a line. Yarrawonga, yes, Lingalonga and Yarrawonga. That's the March of the Anzacs. Nothing less than the March of the Anzacs performed there. I don't know who the singer is, but performed by the regimental band of His Majesty's Welsh Guards. What are they doing with our song? Anyway, this year is the centenary of the outbreak of the Great War. It began on the 28th of July 1914. And, of course, dragged on for 4 very grueling years. And the soldiers came from all walks of life. And they did all sorts of things. They fought on the battlefield. They worked as ambulance drivers, stretcher bearers. And, of course, there were nurses there too. Now, we've heard of the British soldiers, such as Siegfried Sassoon, who tried to recreate their experiences of the trenches in writing. But what about the Australians and the New Zealanders, the Anzacs, who put pen to paper in those horrific conditions? Well, the journalist and novelist Mark Dappin has immersed himself in their writing about the war, and he's collected diary entries and memoirs, poetry, letters, reportage in a new collection. It's called From the Trenches, The Best Anzac Writing of World War One. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
I'm good. Now, this is the second time you put together an anthology of war writing. It must be a pretty emotional process, is it, getting deep into all this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I also edited the Penguin Book of Australian War Writing, which covered only non-fiction. There was no poetry or fiction in that, from invasion to Afghanistan. At the same time, I was researching my novel Spirit House about the Burma Railway, and I was reading a lot of Burma Railway memoirs. And at the end of it all, I was just absolutely emotionally exhausted. And... like, seriously horrified and despairing. Mm. And I thought, I'm never going to read or write anything about this again. I'm going to leave war behind and take up, I don't know, butterfly collecting or something.
So what drew you back?
Add to the rich literature of Lepidoptera.
what drew you back?
That's the right way to say it.
What drew you back, Mark?
A break, apart from anything else. And I started a PhD as well at ADFA. Not a good place to escape the military life.
That's the Australian, just to explain, that's the Australian Defence Force Academy for people who are living overseas, listening overseas online. Yes, that would get your head out of war and stuff. Okay, yeah. So how did you decide?
I'm not entirely rational person, but then this, I always knew that there was the possibility of the World War One anthology. It was mooted to me right when I was doing the first book, and I had notes that I'd made, and I had selections that I wanted to make more public. So when the offer came up again, I'd started the PhD, and I'd had a year off war, and I was fairly happy to do it, really. I mean, I was very pleased to do the work, but not as worried about immersing myself in it as I was when I came up from it last time.
And you've really made a call about what is the best writing. I mean, there's some vivid writing that's in letters and so on that you wouldn't necessarily say was the best writing. You've made a kind of quality judgment here, haven't you?
Well, it's the only thing I was qualified to do. I mean, I'm not an academic. Even though I hope to be in 2 years' time when I graduate with a doctorate from ADFA, all I could do was decide for myself what prose was the strongest. It's not necessarily the writing that's the most significant, certainly not the most significant politically or historically, but it was the work of the soldiers and nurses, to a small extent, that I thought was the most accomplished.
Mm. So there are some famous names here. There's A.B. Facey and Banjo Patterson, Keith Murdoch, the journalist, and the historian Bean, C.W. Bean, Henry Lawson. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk a lot about the horror of war, and there's plenty of horror in this collection, but what's very confronting about this is the book reminds us of an uncomfortable fact, that there are some men who loved being in battle.
There were some men who loved being in battle, and there were quite a lot of men who preferred being in battle to not being in battle. I think that's a fact that is lost something that we find difficult to come to terms with when we who do not go to war think about war. We think about it solely as a tragedy, but a lot of men find it very exciting. And it's the long periods of boredom in between that they resent and hate rather than the brief contacts with the enemy.
In your introduction, you quote a letter from a collection that was put together by Bill Gammage years ago. What was that? 1974 he put together, The Broken Years. And I'm astonished that you quoted this because it's a letter that stuck in my mind ever since I read it back in 74. It was a Lance Corporal W. Francis who wrote, "The bloody gorgeousness of feeling your bayonets go into soft, yielding flesh. They run, we after them. You know, in goes the bayonet the handiest way." He loved it.
I mean, that's what I meant when I was talking about the despair I faced when I did the initial anthology. There's a lot of things like this. You know, men who were able to express themselves articulately and honestly often express sentiments along those lines. And although it's not a nice thing to face up to, I think we have to come to terms with that, particularly now when we're talking about World War One. How could it ever have happened? I mean, in one small way, it could have happened because some people wanted it to happen and were happy for it to continue because they enjoyed it. And I'm not saying that that's the socio-political causes of the First World War, but it is one reason why it lasted.
Yeah. I'm sure it's not the dominant view, actually. I mean, most people who write about war talk about how dreadful it was, but it's important to understand that there is this other side. There's one poem that really caught my eye too. I wonder whether you'd mind if I read it. It's by Leon Gellert. Perhaps you tell us who he is and then I'll read the poem.
Oh, please. Gellert was a PE teacher who enlisted with the 1st AIF just after the outbreak of the First World War, and he actually began writing his poetry on the troop ship to Turkey. He was injured, I think, at septicemia and dysentery and convalesced in England, was discharged medically unfit. Then he re-enlisted, was found out and discharged again. His book, Songs of a Campaign, a collection of war poetry, saw him fated as, you know, the outstanding Australian poet of the year, of the war, rather, and the year, 1916, whatever it was. But he was never kind of able to replicate that with peacetime poetry. He ended up as a journalist, I think, on Fairfax newspapers. He was a columnist on Fairfax, as I was once. But he never reached anything like the heights of his war writing again. And I guess the esteem in which I hold him as a poet, having read quite a lot of Australian war poetry to put this anthology together, is the fact that I've chosen 7 of his poems. There's nobody really who compares with him for maintaining that standard of quality of an Australian First World War poetry.
Well, you've heard of this one before, Action, and it goes like this. "We always had to do our work at night. I wondered why we had to be so sly. I wondered why we couldn't have our fight under the open sky. I wondered why I always felt so cold. I wondered why the orders seem so slow to come, so whisperingly told, so whisperingly low. I wondered if my packing straps were tight, and wondered why I wondered. Sound went wild, an order came, I ran into the night, wondering why I smiled."
Yeah, I mean, again, that's Geller anticipating contact, combat, with a kind of, you know, sensual desire. To me, it's the smile that crosses, a sort of lascivious smile crossing his lips. And, you know, even a guy like that who was full of empathy and irony and poetry felt that desire to fight and kill in that situation.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and I'm talking to Mark Dappin about a collection he's put together of the best Anzac writing from World War One. It's called From the Trenches. Let's look at some of the others. You've included some letters from Arthur Wynne. Tell us about him. I gather you've got some new material by him that's come to light since you put this together.
Arthur Wynne enlisted as a corporal when he was 19. He served as a signaller and reached the rank of lieutenant by 1918 when he was wounded. I actually didn't know anything about him. He came out of the army, that I found out while I was putting the anthology together, obviously. came out of the army and read modern history at Oxford, and he became a librarian at the V&A in London, where he socialised with writers like Eliot. And in 1929, he produced the first English language translation of All Quiet on the Western Front. You know, I had no idea that that was the work of an Australian from Bathurst in New South Wales. His collected letters include only really the letter I've put in the book about the war, war as war, but it shows, you know, a very deft facility with writing, and I thought it was also of, you know, great historical significance, bearing in mind he was the translator. It's interesting to me that so many of these pieces only came to light fairly recently and under, you know, quite strange circumstances. I mean, the book includes Eric Evans' diaries, which were found by his grandson in a kit bag under his late grandfather's bed in Johannesburg in 1985 and weren't published till 2002. There's also Hubert Anthony's letters, which were found by his son in a barn inside a Globite school case tied up with a leather strap, not made published till 2009. And, you know, Edward Lynch's brilliant Somme Mud, which was written in pencil in 1919 in a stack of school exercise books, which were subsequently eaten by mice. But
yes.
Apparently. But he also left behind a typescript, which finally saw print in 2006. Yeah. Now, something similar happened with Wien's work. His, I think it was great, grandnephew, I wonder if he's listening to this show now, he wrote to me to say that he'd discovered his great uncle's work in similar circumstances in, I think, 2006, and pointed out that there was going to be perhaps a flood of rediscovered and first made public manuscripts in the centenary. And I'm sure he's right. These things are, you know, look under your bed, look in your attic, look in your loft. They clearly are there, even now.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. There'd still be things to be turned up.
Yeah.
Now, look, I guess in these next 4 years, as we commemorate the centenary of one battle after another, there's going to be a lot of patriotic talk and flag waving by people who want to invest their own brand of patriotism in the war. How much patriotic feeling did you find among the soldiers that you looked at?
I think, I mean, it's not controversial to say that when the war began, it began among flags and parades, an enormous patriotic feeling. When it ended, when people had seen the reality of war, there was rather less so. People, I think, come quite quickly to terms with the idea once they're fighting, that they're fighting less for a country or an ideal and more for the men whom they're fighting alongside. No matter what you join up believing you're fighting for in any war, I think you end up fighting for your mates.
One of the writers who's very bitter about the war is Frederick Manning. I must say, one of my favourite writers about the war. And you've got a poem by him that you've headed Grotesque, which compares being in the war to being in the, you know, the damned circles of Dante in the Divine Comedy, so in the Inferno, obviously. And he ends by saying that we, sitting with streaming eyes in the acrid smoke that murks our foul, damp billet, chant bitterly with raucous voices as a choir of frogs in hideous irony our patriotic songs. Very bitter.
Yeah. That's beautiful, isn't it, that final line? And I think, yeah, that says a lot about how people began to turn away from patriotism, but to be honest, not all of them. I mean, there's the strand of kind of dissidents that you might expect that you find, obviously, in English First World War literature, that very violent turn against the violence around them. It doesn't exist to the same extent in a lot of Australian literature. It's clearer in the Kiwi writing that I've gathered in the anthology. A lot of people just seem to kind of shrug off the horror and say, well, you know, I went out to find out what war was like. Now I know what it's like. I'll go back to the bush for 20 years and try and forget about it.
Yeah, of course, there are a lot of people who couldn't talk, though. I mean, we've got to take that into account. There were men who came back who we know were so traumatised. There's such discussions of alcoholism and violence in the 20s among men who were really knocked around by the war, but they didn't record what they felt.
And they were told not to talk. Time and time again, we've told our veterans not to talk. We've told them if they keep quiet about it, it'll go away somehow. I'm not sure that too many people were shocked into speechlessness, although I'm sure some people were. I mean, a society didn't want to listen to their stories, or there was a feeling that this is completely forgotten historically. I'm sure you're aware of it. There was a feeling that returned serviceman was almost a synonym for criminal in the early 1920s. We act as if we've always revered our former soldiers, our ANZACs, but not at all. People are scared of them. People were scared of people who'd come home having killed, especially, as you say, people who were drinking heavily and maybe starting a fight in the saloon bar.
Yes, and bringing the sanitised ANZAC legend into discredit, because you're erecting these monuments with these, you know, fine-looking men on pedestals, and out in the streets you've got the blokes who've taken over a pub and are turning it into a nightmare.
Exactly.
Anyway,
yeah.
Mark, we've got to stop there, but thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on this. And I must say, the sound of Dr. Dappin is rather good, isn't it?
To me, it's got echoes of dentistry.
That might be your next collection. Thank you for talking to us, Mark.
Thanks, mate. See ya.
Mark Dappin, he's the editor of From the Trenches, the best ANZAC writing of World War I, and it's published by Viking.